Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Investors, will the recent market rally continue? Is the worst over or is the worst still to come? Are any of the Singapore banks doing better than the other? And which investors have profited the most and which have been most battered given the recent stock market fluctuations? My special guest today is Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Asia Collect. He joins me live to answer these questions. Arun, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Let's start with a Goldman Sachs call that I came across that says the worst for the U.S. market in terms of a rout is over. The team of strategists led by David Costin in a note on Monday said a previous near-term downside of 2,000 for the S&P 500 is no longer likely. Our year-end S&P 500 target remains 3,000. The team said this in a note to clients. Their target is about 5% higher than where we are now. So would you agree, is the worst of the U.S. market rout over?
So it's quite interesting, right, Michelle? Like, rather than concentrating on specific levels, I think it just goes to show how quickly things can change. Because at the end of the day, we're kind of dealing with a massive unknown, which is the COVID crisis. If you look back like 6 days ago on the 10th of April, we were peaking at close to something like 100,000 new cases every day. And then it dropped over the past 5 days down to 60,000 until yesterday. There was another spike up to like 80,000 cases. So it's all a bit of a chicken and egg situation where we are waiting to see, is there any vaccine coming out? Is social distancing helping substantially? Will there be a massive spike up in cases because of countries like Indonesia and India, where managing the large population is a lot more difficult or not. So it's all a very fluid situation. And hence, you can clearly see not just Goldman Sachs, but various reports that I've been reading. The estimates and the expectations are literally all over the map, and they're continuously changing. Now, all that being said, the market versus the economy can be seeing very different things. Now, in the short run, when you have external factors like the central banks getting involved, that can distort prices substantially. And, boy, has that been happening in the markets ever since the COVID crisis has been spreading around the world. You've seen central banks across the globe, the Fed, the BOJ, the ECB, MAS back at home, have basically become printing machines that are running nonstop. And it's one thing being the lender of last resort by lending to SMEs and consumers, but I'm just a bit concerned about these massive large-scale purchases of pretty much anything that's publicly traded, right? Like investment-grade bonds. Like last week, high-yield bonds came into the picture. BOJ has been buying equities. It will cause a massive distortion to prices versus what might be really happening in the economy. So, as long as the central bank is there, rest be assured, asset prices should be sustained. And thereby you see equity markets, rallying substantially from the lows just a couple of weeks back.
All right. Speaking of prices, the price war between Saudi Arabia and other oil producers is heating up again. We thought we had that story wrapped up at the beginning of the week when the OPEC plus nations announced an agreement to cut production. But now we see that Saudi Arabia is cutting prices anyway. At the same time, with large parts of the global economy on hold, the demand for oil has plunged and storage facilities are starting to fill up, a point that you brought up very eloquently a couple of weeks back. The International Energy Agency predicts that by mid-year, which is not that far away, these facilities will be full. Arun, what I want to ask is this, when that happens, what then? If there is no place left to store the oil, what will the producers do and what does that mean for the market?
Right. So, the OPEC is basically a cartel, right? And the US and the world, for that matter, has never truly trusted the OPEC in terms of what they say vis-a-vis what they actually do. The cut that they announced of close to 10 million barrels a day with the hope that the rest of the oil producing countries can try and cut anywhere from like 3 to 5 million barrels. It had a very small initial reaction with oil prices spiking up a little bit. But then, you know, it all came to fruition where the demand, as you were highlighting, the drop is staggering. And that's ranging anywhere from, the estimates are like 20 to 35%, which basically means something close to 20 to 35 million barrels of oil per day. So a cut of anywhere from 10 to 15% is not going to be anywhere nearly enough. Now you have cases where oil is being stored up, right? Like on land, that is. The only place where oil can go right now are your tankers. And that is one sector that I find to be the most attractive, even with the recent run-up in oil price, in share prices the past couple of weeks to a month. I still think it's the most attractive for a very simple reason. You have this massive case of contango in the oil market, which basically means the price of oil right now is close to, say, $20 in the U.S., but the price of oil in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months in the future, which market participants can hedge, are trading anywhere from like $10 to $15 higher in price. So a person who is, say, a producer of oil or some kind of an oil trader, all they need to do is go up to some of these tanker companies, rent out their tanker for anywhere from 3 months to 9 months' time, buy oil in the market today at a relatively cheap price, or if you're producing it, so be it, store it into these tankers, pay the required lease rate for these tankers, and hedge the future price of oil, locking in the $10 to $15 profit today, by the way, locking in that profit, keeping the oil stored in tankers, and then waiting for 6 months, and then proceeding to sell the oil off or rolling over the contract. So we've seen the prices of, now obviously oil tanker owners are not stupid, they know what's happening in the market space. Their demand is extremely hot right now, not just from producers who want to store their oil somewhere, but also oil traders. To give you some example of numbers, like a VLCC, which is the largest, very large crude carrier, can store something like 2 million barrels on its ship. Suezmaxes and Aframaxes that are relatively smaller ships can store anywhere from like 30 to 50% of, you know, barrels of oil. So where does oil have to go? The only place it can go, because many land storages are actually blocking any more oil to come onto its storage containers, and they've jacked up their prices too because they're filling up, has to go into oil tankers. So I think this is the one space in the market right now where, regardless of the COVID crisis, I think it will be extremely interesting, at least for the next 3 to 6 months.
Well, thanks.
Then the question...
Yes, go ahead.
Sorry, but then the question obviously is, not, you know, while in the short run, you've seen a massive spike up in daily charter rates, what will happen after that, right?
Yeah.
Refineries, which require oil from these oil-producing countries, do not have that much storage in its own location.
Right.
So even after you have all this oil produced and stored in vessels, at the end of the day, when the market economy does recover, you will still need to transport oil, be it on these ships or be it in these landlocked areas, the land storage area, to be transported to the refinery. So I can easily see a situation where Q2, Q3 are extremely robust because of contango of oil. Q4 is also quite robust because if and when the market and the economy opens up and it starts recovering, refineries will need oil again. And thereby you have Q4 also of relatively high charter rates for these oil tankers.
Great to be looking ahead to life past this crisis. You know, we haven't been able to do that for a while, so it's great that we've done that. The COVID-19 gloom, Arun, has been so, you know, we've been seeing more customers turning to online banking. So Singapore's largest bank has numbers to show for this. Over the first 3 months of this year, DBS saw an $8 billion increase in the value of transactions conducted digitally compared to the same period last year. And the bank expects 1 million of its customers will go fully digital by the end of 2020, rolling forward an initial projection by one full year. Let's turn to your assessment of the Singapore bank stocks. My question, are any of the banks in better shape than others?
Right. So payments is obviously, it's great for a headline news that a lot more people are using digital payments rather than actual cash and going to ATMs, etc. The biggest problem, though, that banks have at the end of the day is their loan book. The amount of money they can make by taking consumer deposits and lending that out to, be it consumers, SMEs, MNCs, you name it, at a much higher interest, which is their net interest margin spread. The problem with COVID is that you have a number of SMEs and MNCs, for that matter, have shut shop for, it's been probably about a month, 2 months, and who knows how long that can continue. So the issue comes not in making like the small spread in terms of payments, but the biggest issue is the hit to the balance sheet that all banks across the globe are going to take because of non-performing loans, be it secured or unsecured. In the last couple of days, we've seen the earning results of Bank of America, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs. Pretty much all of their earnings are down anywhere from like 50 to 75%. And not just that, the bigger concern is that they set aside substantial amounts of loan loss reserves against these SME loans and consumer unsecured loans, because even they have no idea of how long and how deep this recession and, dare I say, depression will take place. And I think that's the bigger problem for banks, where even though, especially the banks in Singapore that have like a Fort Knox of a balance sheet and banks in the US, we've seen in the last couple of days, the share prices of banks, especially in Europe, that have been hammered because they've, you know, barely recovered from even the global financial crisis back in 2008, 2009. The US banks that are in a lot more of a solid state in terms of a solid balance sheet, we've seen their share prices correct by 10 to 15%, literally just in the last like 3 days' time. So it's something to be extremely concerned about. That being said, luckily the central bank, the government, they've realized what happened back in 2008. So I'm sure in case if this thing goes substantially worse, there will be many measures that are launched by the central banks to protect banks. But, trading at these current multiples, I do think that it seems to be a fair risk-reward play to go into banks, especially in Singapore and the U.S.
Okay, I want to drill in on banks in the U.S. now. So we have signs of how the economic downturn is affecting financial institutions. If we look at Bank of America and Citigroup, both saying their profits sank more than 40% in the first quarter of the year. JP Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo have reported even steeper drops in profits. And all four banks are now setting aside billions of dollars to offset potentially bad loans. So given what you know, are shares of U.S. banks good buys now?
As I was highlighting earlier, it's extremely difficult to read a balance sheet or the annual report of a bank. Yeah. Trust me, I've tried many times. and I'm not even sure if the CEOs of the banks literally know what kind of nuclear doomsday devices of options that they have in their balance sheet. But that being said, taking a step back and having a little bit more of a macro picture, it really depends on two things. One is how quickly the economy will kickstart again. And that kind of connects with the government on the fiscal side. What are they doing to ensure that even if unemployment spikes up, will they be able to provide enough helicopter money to consumers to ensure that they do not undergo massive defaults of loans on the one side? But then at the same time, you need to have the central banks be willing to support financial institutions. Because while the issue right now is focused more on Main Street, for obvious reasons, the last thing we want is a financial crisis to come into the play also. And, central banks have definitely learned their lesson post-2008 when Lehman Brothers went down. Regardless of the after effects that the public got really, really annoyed, where you have all these massive, overly paid bankers potentially getting bailed out. So moral hazard aside, a financial crisis, which is caused due to a Main Street crisis, can be a hole that even central banks with their unlimited printing machines might find it difficult to come out of.
Okay, speaking of difficulties of institutions and employment, Google's parent company Alphabet says it's going to significantly slow down hiring for the rest of the year. In a memo to employees, Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai listed a few reasons for the move. In addition to the obvious, and by that I mean the pandemic and the contraction in the global economy, he lists a few more reasons. These include delays in acquiring essential equipment for new employees like laptops and security keys, as well as challenges in getting new team members up to speed when everyone is working remotely. So, Arun, if Google, a behemoth of tech, is facing problems like these, what does that mean for other companies that don't have its economic clout?
I mean, you hit the nail on the head, right, Michelle? Like, me in a startup is finding it extremely difficult to hire anyone, not just because we are unsure of what the market what the economy will look like even in 3 months from now. But how do you go about doing the logistics of it, like employment contracts, passing them laptops? How do you train people? How do you ensure that the culture and the vibe of the company is set correctly when a person joins? All of this takes place, which we were taking for granted, honestly, when everyone was sitting in the office and you get a person to come on board. It's a relatively straightforward process. Now, you know, and if we as small scale, as a startup is facing that problem, you have high-tech companies like Google facing that problem, SMEs are obviously facing the exact same issue. So you have problems where even if your underlying business is relatively sound and you need to hire a lot of people very quickly, like say in the food delivery space or in the logistics space, where you do have a lot of demand for your product, even then it's so difficult because supply chains are now shut, right? Like, will you be able to find enough laptops at a reasonable price? Will you be able to buy enough data servers to store that information when your business is building up? Are people, you know, essential services are obviously still going on, but it's extremely difficult to actually implement all of that in a company space right now. So it is extremely challenging, and there really is no good answer to that. But it's honestly very scary to hear when you have MNCs that are doing quite well, that have a lot of demand for their goods, are slowing down hiring. It really is a big question mark as to how SMEs and startups are going to fare in this environment.
Absolutely. Speaking about how things are going to fare, Singapore REITs have seen a recent rally, Arun. My guest yesterday, Kenny Low, who's a REIT expert, said he still expects dividends to be cut as REITs try to conserve cash, but that they are still good long-term plays. What is your REIT outlook for investors?
I'm a bit surprised because the way a REIT works is that at least 90% of their taxable income has to be paid out as a dividend. So it's not exactly that a REIT has an option, unlike other publicly traded companies, where they can choose to save cash. You know, and that's one of the big reasons why I am not that big a fan of a REIT, because the compounding effect of retained earnings, which the company can keep and try and grow internally, is not possible in a REIT because it has to pay out 90% of the taxable income.
Right.
The biggest issue, though, that I find, or the biggest opportunities I find in a REIT is because of their substantial price correction, at least until the last about a month odd, where pretty much any publicly traded instrument has spiked higher given the backing of central banks across the globe, is that it's really important now more than ever to take a much more fundamental approach to each REIT, because each and every one has a very unique, diverse set of tenants. So it's important to actually go through and figure out what are those tenancy agreements. Are they triple net leases? What is the credit quality of all of their tenants? What are the leverage ratios, and what do those leverage ratios look like in case 10 to 20% of their tenants do default, and or they ask for some kind of rental forgiveness, and thereby, but obviously the REIT has to still keep paying the bank interest on that property. What happens to the leverage ratios of this REIT that are typically reasonably highly leveraged structures? What do those ratios look like in 2 to 3 months? Do they break any covenants with the banks, which will force a REIT to like start selling off properties at potentially fire sale prices? So yes, while REIT prices have corrected substantially a while back, and that was one of the first times I was actually exploring buying into REITs, share prices, just like anything else, not just REITs, have spiked so high in the past couple of weeks that it will be interesting to see where finally the reality of the economy will set in. Because at the end of the day, if you have your SMEs and you have your startups failing, especially on the retail segment, mm-hmm. it'll be interesting to see what happens to the strength of the balance sheet or the quality of the balance sheet of these REITs.
Speaking of, a value investor's approach, if we just look at how investors have fared given this market rout and all the bounces and the rallies, Jeff Bezos has added $24 billion to his fortune because online shopping has boosted Amazon's share price. Bezos has an 11% stake in Amazon, and on Tuesday, the firm's shares rose by 5.3%. So I want to... we've got 2 minutes left on the clock, but this is a 30-minute question. Has the rally widened social inequality? And in all of this market turmoil, which investors have really seen a loss in net worth?
it really is a 30-minute question, but I'll try and be as precise as possible. Bezos, God bless his soul, has done a fantastic job of creating Amazon. And, rightfully, he should be getting paid out for this fantastic mousetrap he has set up in the capitalistic world that we live in. Coming to the more existential question of the gap between the haves and the have-nots, and this, I think, is something that we will see the after effects play out over the next 5 to 10 years. And as an investor and a human being in this world, is something that I'm the most concerned about. Ray Dalio has compared this to a pre-World War II era because the similarities are quite uncanny, right? You have central banks who propped up publicly traded instruments to such an extent that rewards the haves a lot more than the have-nots. You have your daily wage workers who are struggling right now because they are unable to even get out of their houses. And that can lead to this massive inequality, which the world was already suffering from, to a point where, will this actually come out to some kind of massive civil war, or God forbid, something like what happened, what were the causes of World War II? It's important, while capitalism works, it's very important to ensure that inequality is controlled and maintained somehow. Like, by maintained, I mean like improved. And there's this fascinating piece between these two billionaires, Shamat, who's this Indian Thai person, if I'm not mistaken, and Leon Cooperman, who's a billionaire hedge fund investor in the U.S., where they've talked about this to a lot more detail of an extent. So I highly recommend, viewing those two clips on YouTube to all the investors.
Well, thank you very much. I love it when an interview ends with a reading list like that. Appreciate it. You have a wonderful day, Arun.
Thank you. You too, Michelle.
That's Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Asia Collect Investors, weighing in on whether this recent market rally will continue and what's ahead, giving us a view of the landscape, the economic landscape past COVID-19 as well. Fascinating. 10:29 on the clock. The news is straight ahead.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.